Good morning. I'm Cal Winslow, your host, and this morning, welcome back to our new series, Where Are We Now? Our purpose is to examine some of our most urgent concerns, climate change, international conflict, gender, race, and inequality, and the state of the Earth's resources as we enter this period of transition. Our guest this morning is Professor Judith Butler. Judith Butler is the Maxine Elliott Professor in the Department of Comparative Literature and the Program of Critical Theory at the University of California, Berkeley. She received her PhD in philosophy from Yale University in 1984. She's the author of many books. I'll just list a few: Subjects of Desire, Gender Trouble, Bodies That Matter, The Psychic Life of Power, Excitable Speech, Antigone's Claim, Precarious Life, Undoing Gender, Frames of War. Professor Butler served as founding director of the Critical Theory Program at UC Berkeley, served as department chair of the Department of Rhetoric in 1998, and the acting chair of the Department of Gender and Women's Studies in 2002. She's served on the Executive Council of the Modern Languages Association and chaired its Committee on Academic Freedom. She's also affiliated with the Psychosocial MA program at Birkbeck College in London and the European Graduate School in Switzerland. Professor Butler is active in several human rights organizations, currently serving on the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York and on the advisory board of the Jewish Voice for Peace. She received the Adorno Prize from the city of Frankfurt in honor of her contributions to feminist and moral philosophy, and the Brudner Prize from Yale University for lifetime achievement in gay and lesbian studies. I must say that this is just a very small part of a very long CV to see it all, and I hope you will. Please have a look at jpbutler@berkeley.edu. Good morning, Professor Butler.
Good morning.
Can I call you Judith? Is that
all? Sure, that's fine.
Okay, well, our program has been looking at what we might say is the state of things today. You know, what's the situation now? What's been done, not done? How did we get here? What's at stake in the days to come? I think your book, Gender Trouble, is very rightly concerned a classic in its field. Maybe we could begin there with gender and feminism, LGBT rights. Can you introduce us to that? Perhaps think about a sort of balance sheet?
Well, it depends what you're asking. Are you asking about my scholarship, on gender, or you want me to talk a little bit about gender and feminism now?
Yeah, I think the state of thinking about the subjects, the state of the movements, what rights have been achieved or what not, kind of in a broadly the state of the women's movement in the face of the new administration, the state of gender and LGBT movements.
Okay, well, I would say that there have been enormous strides in thinking about gender and in movements that seek to enhance gender freedom over the last several decades. So, I started writing on gender in the late 1980s, and at that point, we barely had something called queer theory or queer studies, and feminism was highly debated, and there was an effort to try to make room for lesbian, gay, bisexual people within the study of gender and sexuality. I think since that time, we have seen the emergence of transgender rights groups and an enormous mobilization to draw attention to the lives of transgendered people, both their struggle for freedom and their desires for recognition, but also perhaps the suffering and discrimination that they have endured. And there's been a very strong public presence of transgender people in the media and in the entertainment business, but also in the law. So we've seen great strides in that way. I think feminism has been struggling to hold on to its gains, and we are, of course, now in the middle of a regime that clearly has targeted Roe versus Wade. So we may well see the slow or fast destruction of reproductive freedoms for women, and we know that that the destruction of those freedoms will affect poor women, women with little or no access to health care. It will produce, take us back to the time of illegal abortions conducted under unsafe conditions. So right now, I do think that reproductive rights and reproductive health politics is at the forefront of feminist politics, as it has to be. I must say that some people thought the Trump election was the death knell to feminism, but I actually think that with his overt misogyny and his despicable treatment of Hillary Clinton and any number of women with whom he has worked and sexually harassed, we saw how timely feminism still is and why it is we can't call ourselves post-feminist anymore. It's not as if feminism has achieved its goal. That is not true. We also saw there was popular support for Trump's hatred of women, his misogyny, and that lets us know that our work is hardly over.
And what about misogyny? Where do you think, how do you analyze that? Where is it coming from? How, say, if it represents, you suggested it's somewhat widespread. Where does it come from? Why do you think it developed the way it seems to have in the campaign, the Trump campaign?
Well, I think that on the one hand, Trump represents a number of men and actually some women who have resented feminism for a long time. They tend to think that feminism is a kind of police or a kind of censor, and I see on the Breitbart pages that feminists are regularly called fascists. So so that means that there's an image of feminism as negative, as controlling, as judgmental, even as censorious and as policing. And of course, that's a huge media problem for feminism now, because the task before us is to show that it is, in fact, a struggle for freedom. It's a struggle for equality. It's a struggle for inclusion. It's also a struggle for justice. And those are basic democratic values that have not been fully realized for women, and especially for poor women and for women of color throughout this country. We're also seeing institutional efforts at deportation on the part of the Trump state that will differentially affect women and in many cases separate them from children and family. So when you ask where it comes from, of course, this is an age-old question. We could offer a psychological reading. We can offer a sociological reading or an historical reading. I suppose for me, at this historical moment, I'm asking how it's being reproduced and what its contemporary form is. So I think that we are seeing a lot of people emboldened to unleash their feminism, their anti-feminism, to unleash their misogyny, to speak out about their resentment against women, their belief that women should not be in the workplace, or that women should not be paid as much as men, or the idea that women ought not to be in politics or in the public sphere in the same way that men are. I think as well, if we consider the enormous rage against Hillary Clinton, in part that was a refusal on the part of a number of people to imagine that a woman could symbolically embody the nation or represent the nation in the public sphere. So we still have a lot of work to do, and I think we have to get savvy about why people think of feminism, many people think of feminism in these negative terms, and why actually everyone should be invested in seeing feminism flourish. It will produce a better world for men and women and people of various genders.
And would you mind just stepping back a minute and explaining a bit more about the connection that you suggested with the issue of immigrants and deportations?
Well, I do think that as of now, and I haven't had a chance to read through the full text of Trump's second effort at immigration control and travel bans, but as of now, it seems to me that women who come to this country undocumented have a much more difficult time trying to find work. They're very often separated from their family or trying to get back to their family, or they brought their family or had children here, but their legal status is not the same as the status of their children. So a child born here may be able to keep rights of citizenship or be accelerated through that process of legalization, but someone else who came here without documents may well find herself in a much more vulnerable position. I don't think that the Trump administration is thinking about any of this or has any compassion for people who are in this particular situation.
And do you think of the issues of feminism and misogyny and LGBT rights, all of that, as discrete in themselves, or do we have something which is kind of connected with the whole range of Trump's projects or proposed projects?
Well, I think right now we do have alliances building among people who identify primarily as feminists or people who identify with the LGBTQ movement, different parts of that movement, people who are opposing xenophobia, opposing racism again against Mexicans, xenophobia against people from Latin America, but also obviously people from Arab countries, especially Muslims. I think if you oppose discrimination on the basis of gender, you oppose discrimination on the basis of sexuality, you also will oppose discrimination on the basis of race and nationality. So these are obvious allies, and it seems to me that at this point there could be nothing more important than building and securing those coalitions.
Okay, and how? What about the women's marches and the potential there? Could you comment on that?
Well, I think the women's marches were great. I thought it was amazing to see people turning out across the United States, but also in many other cities across the globe in solidarity with the Women's March. It was a clear message to the Trump administration that women are going to fight this. They will fight his not just his despicable comments and his status as a sexual harasser, which is, after all, a criminal status. But that they will also fight his policies, and that they will stand in solidarity against against his administration as they seek to roll back civil rights and gender rights legislation that has been really crucial for the movement.
Okay, and changing the subject just a bit here. I want to be careful how to say this, but I think you're known as sort of a theorist in the field that you're in, that you, you've been important in the development, I think it's fair to say, of what's called queer theory. Your first book was called Gender Trouble. Could you tell us a little bit about, if I'm not way off on that, about what the work of a theorist is and what you've been trying to do?
Well, I think that it's important to realize that people who work in the academy are also teachers. We write, we teach, we mentor. We also try to keep the public institution of the University of California alive, so we do service on campus as well. And when we're not in the university, we're very often involved in social movements or we take part in the communities where we live. So although, yes, you could say I am a theorist, theory is one part of my life, it's part of what I do, I'm also a person who does any number of other things and has various engagements and commitments. And I think, for me at least, when I started working on gender, I was clearly responding to the fact that there was not just a strong feminist movement that at the time didn't really know how to think about gender nonconformity very well, but also an emerging gay and lesbian bisexual movement within the academy. At that point, trans was not central, but now it certainly is, and that's a good thing. So I was responding to social movements and trying to teach about them and think about some of the key concepts that people use when they're in social movements. For instance, they're struggling for emancipation. Well, emancipation from what? What's our concept of emancipation? Marx had an idea. Paulo Freire had another idea when it comes to pedagogy. What's our idea? What would an emancipated world look like? So one teaches those kinds of concepts. Or gender, when you say, this is my gender, or you ask someone, what gender are you? What is it you expect as an answer? What do we think gender is? How do we define it? And how is it practiced or performed in the world? And what does that make about how we understand it? So these were all key concepts that I saw floating about in the world, and I certainly saw them as essential to social movements that were concerned with realizing freedom and achieving equality and recognition. And I sought to use my academic life in part to try to clarify some of those key concepts. Of course, you know, activists from those movements also go to the university and study, and then they leave the university and go back to those movements. So, you know, there's a back and forth that's very productive, in my view.
Okay, Judith, let me pause for a moment here. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this morning, Cal Winslow. Our program this morning is Where Are We Now? And our guest is Judith Butler, the professor of comparative literature and critical theory at the University of California in Berkeley. One last point. We were talking about theory. I was wondering if it might be worth saying something about this gender trouble. Well, what was the trouble, or what is the trouble?
Well, I think that sometimes within feminist theory, there's a strong sense that it's women who should be making the theory and that they should be basing that theory on their experience. And some women have a very firm sense of who they are as women, and others have always been bothered by the category or maybe don't call themselves women or feel that some of the values and norms associated with femininity are not those that describe who they are or characterize the life they want to live. So gender trouble was a rebellion against certain norms of femininity that I saw as central to feminist theory at the time. And I asked what difference it would make if we take the perspective of somebody who does not conform to gender norms.
Well, first, maybe just for the listener, the norms you're pointing to?
Well, I think there are norms of appearance and norms of behavior that are understood as recognizably feminine. And And although feminism has always criticized that, saying we should be free to appear as we wish and to dress as we wish, there are also some norms that make their way into feminist theory. For instance, women are closer to nature than men are, or women are more peaceable than men are, or women are more feeling and less rational. Some feminists embrace those descriptions of the difference between men and women. And that that I found hard to take, and I couldn't live peaceably in a feminism of that kind.
So you...
I made some trouble.
Let's talk about that a little more.
Well, I did make some trouble because, I mean, why do we think gender is just men and women? Maybe there are other terms that suit people's lives. And indeed, we've seen many people developing now different terminology for their gendered lives. Some people say they're non-binary. They belong neither to the category of men nor to the category of women. They're self-defining, or they have other terms. Some people understand themselves as a complex combination of those terms. Some people have moved from an original sex assignment as female to being men. They've gone through a transition into a trans identity. Or the other way around, those who are assigned at birth with one gender have changed. So I think that that in fact there's a great deal of variation among people, not only in terms of their sexual orientation. The language for which is not always helpful, but gender itself, and I tried to make that plain.
Okay, and before we go to a new subject, you used the word, maybe asked the question earlier, what would an emancipated world look like? Now, that's a difficult one, but when you're imagining things, can you give us a hint at all about what would be important for you?
Well, I mean, at the most basic level, I believe we should be struggling for a world in which minorities, those who suffer from poverty and lack of work, those who suffer racial discrimination or religious discrimination, those who have experienced discrimination or violence on the basis of their sexuality or gender or race, or all of those things, should be able to live and breathe in a world in a free way and without the fear of violence. So that's my view, and that's what I struggle for.
Okay. And now you've mentioned violence, and you've written about that as well. I guess we could argue a bit about this, but the United States, it seems, has been continuously at war now, at least since 2001 and the invasion of Afghanistan, where war continues. You've written about victims and grieving and so forth. You have a new book, or newish book, Frames of War. What led you into writing about those kinds of subjects?
When I was working in more focused way on gender, I was aware that many times in the course of the AIDS crisis here in the United States, people would lose their lives, lovers would lose their loved ones, and there was no public mourning or insufficient public mourning. And it made me very, very angry, because not only had some people been unable to gain public recognition for the love they had, but then they didn't gain public recognition for the loss they suffered. So I developed some thoughts about the importance of public grieving. And then after 9/11, I was actually living very close to New York at the time, and I saw that those a certain kind of person who had died in the Twin Towers destruction was actively and publicly mourned, but other people clearly were not, and those the United States had killed abroad were never publicly mourned. So one question is, why is it we don't mourn the loss of those the United States has killed? And do we consider them less than human? Do we consider them not worthy of being publicly grieved? So I started writing on that topic, and then I became interested not only in understanding how and why the U.S. Engages in military destruction as it does, but also how it disavows the kinds of destruction it unleashes on the world. So I've been interested in how the United States disavows the destruction of lives abroad, and also very often disavows the loss of life here in the U.S. Certainly, what has been happening to black men and women on the streets and in the prisons, their lives also strike me as not fully grievable in the public eye. So that's what I've been thinking about these days.
And how would we go about writing something like that?
Well, I think that we would have to actively contest, as the Black Lives Matter movement does contest, the rationale that the police give for killing people on the streets, especially unarmed people who happen to be black and who tend to be male. I think that kind of killing communicates that those lives are not considered to be valuable lives. They're not lives at all. And if they are, it doesn't matter. So I think we have to somehow regalvanize a movement that allows us to recognize the equal value of life.
Okay, and what about this is, I suppose, kind of a set of questions, but at times we've heard about humanitarian interventions, and the idea was at least tried on us that the invasion of Afghanistan was humanitarian, or that there are other places in Africa where women are mistreated that we ought to be involved. I guess the subject of women's rights in the Muslim world is always put in our face. How would you respond to those kinds of issues? Should we be concerned about women's rights in, say, Afghanistan, or if so, how?
Well, first of all, yes, I think we should be concerned about women's rights everywhere, but I think it would be best if we started right here and asked about whether we have secured reproductive rights for women, whether women are making an equal wage, whether women are protected from domestic violence. As we know, women are much more likely in the United States to be killed by a man they know than by any other person. So our work is cut out for us right here. I think there are some strong feminist movements in Afghanistan and in various parts of the Middle East that are already operating. And if people in the U.S. want to make solidarity with those movements and work with them, I think that's great. I would be opposed to forms of paternalistic humanitarianism. I think we have to make transnational bonds of solidarity and work together on as equals.
Okay. More questions here. And changing our course a bit. Judith, that you're a professor of critical studies at Berkeley, and I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about the meaning of critical. We've had a bit on our program, and we had a presentation on critical race theory. I wonder, is there a theory of critical gender in women's studies? But first of all, the basic idea of critical studies. Aren't all studies critical?
No, not all of them are. Well, first of all, it's called critical theory, and that term was developed in the 1930s and 40s when a number of important German intellectuals who were opposed to the rise of fascism collected together and and many of them were in the process of leaving Germany. They some of them were Jews, others were at risk. But they built a university in exile, which eventually came to be the New School in New York. And it was dedicated to thinking about contemporary forms of domination, to a critique of fascism, to a critique of authoritarianism, to a critique of inequality. And their view was that many of our ways of knowing within the, many of our methods within the social sciences, maybe many of our ways of thinking about history, reproduce the assumptions of the status quo rather than offer a critical understanding about how those assumptions came about. So, for instance, do we accept that the economy has to be a market economy? At what point did the market economy become the only way to think about the economy? What happened to other versions? What happened to socialism? What happened to communism? What about forms of self-sufficient economies, autonomous economies, barter economies? So, you know, asking how certain kinds of assumptions take hold and why it is we can't think outside of them, especially in the academy, became one of the tasks of critical theory. And, of course, also developing ways of dissenting, from authoritarian regimes, dissenting from fascism, and modes of resistance. How do we think about that? How do we plan it? How do we justify it? How do we think about the open critique of state institutions, even when it means risking imprisonment or exile? Those were all key questions for many of the people in the Frankfurt School. And now I think critical theory has taken many forms. You've heard on your program apparently about critical race theory. That's a very, very important a very, very important field, and it also asks about how racial presumptions are built into our legal discourse and our legal system and tries to develop new vocabulary so that we can achieve a more racially just legal world and legal strategy. But also there are many ways of thinking today about emerging forms of nationalism, which we see in this country and in Europe and in parts of Latin America. How do we think about xenophobia? How do we think about many of the historical issues of our time using interdisciplinary methods, that is, bringing together people from history, sociology, literature, and the arts to think together about these matters and to develop an interdisciplinary perspective that can embolden and strengthen a critical understanding of society.
Okay, and to what extent would you say critical theory is Marxist, what I suppose, whatever that is, but I to the degree that over the longer period people have thought about Marxism, was the development of critical theory a departure from, you know, quotes, classical Marxism?
Well, it remains tied to Marxism. There's no question about it. And many of the many of the early critical theorists, as well as contemporary ones, are very concerned with how capitalism works, and they think about the commodity, which is such a central category for Marx, and how it affects human relations and our relations to the earth. But I think the idea is that there are certain forms of power that can't be explained exclusively through capitalism, that we need to develop other models. The history of racism, that for instance, cross-cuts capitalism. There are pre-capitalist versions in ancient Greece. There are versions that don't necessarily depend upon capitalism. And what about misogyny, or what about other forms of domination, or even colonial subjection? The history of colonialism is not simply a history of capitalism. It has its own logic, and it's got its own meaning. So we have to think about intersecting complex forms of power, which is one reason why critical theory has to be interdisciplinary.
So if I signed up to be a major at UC in critical theory, if there is such a what typically?
Oh, we're not a major for undergraduates. We're a specialization for graduate students. But yes, undergraduates can be introduced to critical theory in English, in political science, in anthropology, in French, in German, in all those different. We have faculty in all those different departments who work in this area.
So faculties from your program teach in the various departments?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So here's a question that maybe some listeners might identify with this. I don't know. When I was a youngster, we all had to take a course called Ideas and Institutions of Western Civilization. It was required. Now, what would be the difference between one taught in a, I suppose we could say, a traditional way and one taught by a critical theorist?
Well, I suppose that when you look at an intellectual text, like let's say you're reading Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, and you walk into your great books class and they say, this is one of the greatest economic theorists of our time. He showed us how the market economy works, and you're going to learn from Adam Smith why the market economy is reconciled with freedom, and that if we want to be free as a society, we should subscribe to a market economy, and we should be really pleased we're living in a capitalist world. So that's, you know, I could just teach that, like this is what Adam Smith said, and this is how he puts it together, and here's his argument, and I would ask you to, you know, I could, if I were just teaching it straight, as it were, I'd just ask you to reproduce that argument, and then you would have mastered one of the great texts of Western Civ, and you would walk out saying, I know what Adam Smith said, and I understand his argument, and he's really great, and that means that we value him, and it implicitly means we also kind of accept what he has to say. Now, if I teach Adam Smith as a critical theorist, I'm going to find out a little bit, first of all, about the historical situation in which he's writing, and ask how does his work reflect that historical situation? What kind of transition is Europe going through at that time? And what's happening with industrialization? What's happening as the economy moves from an agrarian economy to an industrial urban one? And we might ask, is he rationalizing a certain kind of process? Is he affirming it? Is he criticizing it? What are his blind spots? What does he not see? How would we develop critical understanding of Adam Smith that situates him in his social world, but also develops a different set of values than the ones that he himself propounds, right? I wouldn't ask you to accept, actually, in any text, that this is unequivocally great. You would have to weigh whether you think the arguments are good or bad, and you develop a kind of independent understanding of the social world and the particular forms of power that are being registered in that text and being reproduced by that text, and maybe you would end up like Marx, thinking, "Oh, we need this text because it's going to help us dismantle capitalism." You never know.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to pause again. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio, and I'm your host, Cal Winslow, and our guest today is Professor Judith Butler from the University of California at Berkeley, and we've been talking about things like queer theory and critical theory, critical studies. Here's another subject, the university. You talked about yourself as a person who has to wear many hats, and one has to wonder. The state of California seems to be different than the rest of the country in many ways, and possibly better. At the same time that we're hearing about the kind of cuts that the administration has in store for us, we see that students again are going to have their tuition raised at the university, and we don't see much movement in terms of making the university more open. We don't hear much about the idea of public education being what once was. As a senior professor, are these issues that concern you?
Yes, they concern me greatly. I'm very alarmed that the University of California has become unaffordable for many of the students who once thought that it would be within their reach. And I've also seen students leave the university every time tuition goes up because they're barely able to pay the tuition as it is. And that means, of course, that we're servicing people who are wealthier, and that the promise of public education as affordable and accessible is not being kept, and that's enormously concerning to me. I think people have come up with other ways to think about the budget and funding, but my impression is that the UC administration is heading down the road of privatization, and at a certain point, I'm not sure what it will mean to call ourselves a public university.
Well, you should explain that, Professor. I'm sorry, Judith, you should explain that. That's a pretty serious worry that you're raising there.
Well, I think many of us have been in public discussions about the privatization of the university, and what that basically means is that we don't have sufficient funding from the state, and we can't raise sufficient funding from tuition, and we ought not to be relying on increasing tuition for our funding. And we turn to private industries to fund our buildings and our programs, to finance faculty chairs and research, and more we are being encouraged to enter into partnerships with businesses and to pursue entrepreneurial solutions to the problem of basic funding. And that's of course, very worrisome. One worry is that those businesses could have more of an influence on what we study and why we study what we study. We do have some rules suggesting that our scholarship can't be geared just in directions that will make profit for a corporation that is invested in the university. But in fact, many times that line is already crossed. And of course, the arts and humanities, they're not as eligible for large science grants or large partnerships with corporations. So they're hit hardest, and that's terrible because a university without strong arts and humanities is not really a university.
And I suppose we should mention that the public is not always perfect as well, in terms of the military aspects of education and research at the California universities.
Yes, that's true. But I think if the University of California and the Cal State system as well are not properly funded by the state, if that's not made into a strong priority, then they will increasingly turn to private industry or science grants or military grants to get the funding they need. And that does skew our sense of what we're about and why we do the work that we do.
Okay. Last question. We're coming toward the end here. Let's go back to the beginning and thinking over the history of feminist movements and gender movements, LGBTQ movements. What can you imagine in terms of forms that, if we use the word resistance, of that forms of resistance might take? Or would you make any suggestions about what forms are good and maybe not so good?
Well, right now, I find it interesting that, of course, many people on the left are appalled every day by what Trump says and what he seeks to do. But we're also showing up in large numbers at demonstrations, and we're calling public officials, and we're getting together, sometimes in small groups that have that are consoling in some ways. But the truth is, we have to expand our alliances and start to plan a resistance that includes people we may not always have thought we had something to do with. So, for instance, if there are civil servants who are refusing to implement orders to deport undocumented people, or if there are police forces or whole cities that refuse to implement the ban on people from certain countries or the deportation practices, then those people are also our allies, and they may not agree with us on a lot of other issues, but that doesn't matter. We don't have to agree on every issue to have a resistance movement against an increasingly authoritarian and arguably fascist regime. So that has to be our, in my view, our priority is expanding solidarity beyond our usual circles so that we can have a broad-based resistance to this regime. I also think, you know, we have voter suppression in this country, and we need to really look at that and bring to court those cases that are clear acts of discrimination. We need investigative journalism to uncover voter suppression and really make that into a public issue that we can address. But there's also about 50% of the eligible voters who didn't show up for this last election. What's going on with them? We need to know. Why are they disillusioned with politics? Why do they think electoral politics doesn't matter to them? Why don't they feel a part of this country? The part of the country that's seeking to determine its own political fate or express its political will. They don't understand themselves as part of the electorate. So maybe it's demoralization. Maybe it's anger. Maybe it's hopelessness. Maybe they didn't think that their vote was important. But trying to find out who that 50% is and working with them to make a left agenda persuasive, that would be a really good idea. We should all be spending our time on that.
Okay, and is that relevant to students as you know them at UC today? Are they asking questions that are going in the right direction?
I think they are asking those questions. The students I know are trying to finish their studies. They're trying to make the money that they need in order to pay for their studies, and they're also trying to understand how best to engage in the world. Many of them are very concerned with the environment and the prospect that the Trump administration will roll back environmental protections in order to expand markets everywhere. And they're doing what they can in the areas where they have talent and passion.
Okay, and to end up, I'm sure you're probably in the midst of a dozen or more projects, but what's something that you're working on now? Do you that the listeners might be interested in, and do you have a book that of your own that you might suggest that people pick up and have a look at?
Well, I do have a co-edited book with Duke University Press. It's called Vulnerability in Resistance, and it focuses on some of the major demonstrations of the last 7 years, looking at how people who are opposing globalization at the corporate level or opposing authoritarianism in Turkey or who are part of the Occupy movement, how they assembled, how they gathered, how they put their bodies on the line in order to make a graphic point about what they didn't like about corporate capitalism or about authoritarianism, but also seeking to embody new principles of interdependency and freedom that would offer a socialist or social, at least a social democratic alternative to the status quo. So, and that includes writings by women from various countries. It was an act of international solidarity, and it's a good volume.
And tell us again the title. And
it's called Vulnerability in Resistance. So it's about feminism and resistance movements and what role the body plays.
And
in activism.
Okay, and the publisher?
Is Duke University Press.
Okay. Judith, thank you very much. This has been really interesting, really informative, and I know you're very busy, and so it's been generous of you to take your time out of the work that you do to talk to us, and I think the listeners would all agree with me. The program this morning has been Where Are We Now? Next time, 2 weeks from this morning, we'll be back. Speakers to come in the series include Susanna Hecht, Julie Guthmans, Michael Watts, Richard Walker. So I hope you'll tune in. So again, Judith, thanks very much.